But beneath all this variety, might there be some general principles or artistic universals that cut across cultural boundaries? Can we come up with a science of art? Science and art seem fundamentally antithetical. One is a quest for general principles and tidy explanations, while the other is a celebration of the individual imagination and spirit, so that the very notion of a science of art seems like an oxymoron. Yet that is my goal for this chapter and the next, to convince you that our knowledge of human vision and of the brain is now sophisticated enough that we can speculate intelligently on the neural basis of art and maybe begin to construct a scientific theory of artistic experience. Saying this does not in any way detract from the originality of the individual artist, for the manner in which she deploys these universal principles is entirely hers. First, I want to make a distinction between art, as defined by historians, and the broad topic of aesthetics. Because both art and aesthetics require the brain to respond to beauty, there is bound to be a great deal of overlap. But art includes such things as Dada, whose aesthetic value is dubious, whereas aesthetics include such things as fashion design, which is not typically regarded as high art. Maybe there can never be a science of high art, but I suggest there can be the principles of aesthetics that underlie it. Many principles of aesthetics are common to both humans and other creatures, and therefore cannot be the result of culture. Can it be a coincidence that we find flowers to be beautiful, even though they evolved to be beautiful to bees rather than to us? This is not because our brains evolved from bee brains, they didn't, but because both groups independently converged on some of the same universal principles of aesthetics. The same is true for why we find male birds of paradise such a feast for the eyes, to the point of using them as headdresses, even though they evolved for females of their own species and not for Homo sapiens. Some creatures, such as bower birds from Australia and New Guinea, possess what we humans perceive as artistic talent. The males of the genus are drab little fellows, but perhaps as a Freudian compensation, they build enormous, gorgeously decorated bowers, bachelor pads, to attract mates. One species builds a bower that is 8 feet tall, with elaborately constructed entranceways, archways, and even lawns in front of the entryway. On different parts of the bower, he arranges clusters of flowers into bouquets, sorts berries of various types by color, and forms gleaming white hillocks out of bits of bone and eggshell. Smooth, shiny pebbles arranged into elaborate designs are often part of the display. If the bowers are near human habitation, the bird will borrow bits of cigarette foil or shiny shards of glass, the avian equivalent of jewelry, to provide accent. The male bower bird takes great pride in the overall appearance and even fine details of his structure. Displace one berry, and he will hop over to put it back, showing the kind of fastidiousness seen in many a human artist. Different species of bower birds build discernibly different nests, and most remarkable of all, individuals within a species have different styles. In short, the bird shows artistic originality, which serves to impress and attract individual females. If one of these bowers were displayed in a Manhattan art gallery without revealing that it was created by a bird brain, I'd wager it would elicit favorable comments. Returning to humans, one problem concerning aesthetics has always puzzled me. What, if anything, is the key difference between kitsch art and real art? Some would argue that one person's kitsch might be another person's high art. In other words, the judgment is entirely subjective. But if a theory of art cannot objectively distinguish kitsch from the real, how complete is that theory? And in what sense can we claim to have really understood the meaning of art? One reason for thinking that there's a genuine difference is that you can learn to like real art after enjoying kitsch, but it's virtually impossible to slide back into kitsch after knowing the delights of high art. Yet the difference between the two remains tantalizingly elusive. In fact, I will lay out a challenge that no theory of aesthetics can be said to be complete unless it confronts this problem and can objectively spell out the distinction. In this chapter, I'll speculate on the possibility that real art, or indeed aesthetics, involves the proper and effective deployment of certain artistic universals, whereas kitsch merely goes through the motions, as if to make a mockery of the principles without a genuine understanding of them. This isn't a full theory, but it's a start. For a long time, I had no real interest in art. Well, that isn't entirely true, because any time I'd attend a scientific meeting in a big city, I would visit the local galleries, if only to prove to myself that I was cultured. But it's fair to say I had no deep passion for art. But all that changed in 1994 when I went on a sabbatical to India and began what was to become a lasting love affair with aesthetics. During a 3-month visit to Chennai, also known as Madras, the city in southern India where I was born, I found myself with extra time on my hands. I was there as a visiting professor at the Institute of Neurology to work on patients with stroke, phantom limbs following amputation, or a sensory loss caused by leprosy. The clinic was undergoing a dry spell, so there weren't many patients to see. This gave me ample opportunity for leisurely walks through the Shiva temple in my neighborhood in Mylapore, which dates back to the first millennium BCE. A strange thought occurred to me as I looked at the stone and bronze sculptures, or idols, as the English used to call them, in the temple. In the West, these are now found mostly in museums and galleries, and are referred to as Indian art. Yet I grew up praying to these as a child, and never thought of them as art. They are so well integrated into the fabric of life in India, the daily worship, music, and dance, that it's hard to know where art ends and where ordinary life begins. Such sculptures are not separate strands of existence, the way they are here in the West. Until that particular visit to Chennai, I had a rather colonial view of Indian sculptures, thanks to my Western education. I thought of them largely as religious iconography or mythology, rather than fine art. Yet on this visit, these images had a profound impact on me as beautiful works of art, not as religious artifacts. When the English arrived in India during Victorian times, they regarded the study of Indian art mainly as ethnography and anthropology. This would be equivalent to putting Picasso in the anthropology section of the National Museum in Delhi. They were appalled by the nudity and often described the sculptures as primitive or not realistic. For example, the bronze sculpture of Parvati, which dates back to the zenith of southern Indian art during the Chola period, AD 12th century, is regarded in India as the very epitome of feminine sensuality, grace, poise, dignity, and charm. Indeed, of all that is feminine. Yet when the Englishmen looked at this and other similar sculptures, they complained that it wasn't art because the sculptures didn't resemble real women. The breasts and hips were too big, the waist too narrow. Similarly, they pointed out that the miniature paintings of the Mughal or Rajasthani school often lacked the perspective found in natural scenes. In making these criticisms, they were, of course, unconsciously comparing ancient Indian art with the ideals of Western art, especially classical Greek and Renaissance art, in which realism is emphasized. But if art is about realism, why even create the images? Why not just walk around looking at things around you? Most people recognize that the purpose of art is not to create a realistic replica of something, but the exact opposite. It is to deliberately distort, exaggerate, even transcend realism in order to achieve certain pleasing and sometimes disturbing effects in the viewer. And the more effectively you do this, the bigger the aesthetic jolt. Picasso's cubist pictures were anything but realistic. His women, with two eyes on one side of the face, hunchbacks, misplaced limbs, and so on, were considerably more distorted than any Chola bronze or Mughal miniature. Yet the Western response to Picasso was that he was a genius who liberated us from the tyranny of realism by showing us that art doesn't have to even try to be realistic. I do not mean to detract from Picasso's brilliance, but he was doing what Indian artists had done a millennium earlier. Even his trick of depicting multiple views of an object in a single plane was used by mogul artists. I might add that I am not a great fan of Picasso's art. Thus, the metaphorical nuances of Indian art were lost on Western art historians. One eminent bard, the 19th-century naturalist and writer Sir George Christopher Molesworth Birdwood, considered Indian art to be mere crafts and was repulsed by the fact that many of the gods had multiple arms, often allegorically signifying their many divine attributes. He referred to Indian art's greatest icon, the dancing Shiva, or Nataraja, which appears in the next chapter, as a multi-armed monstrosity. Oddly enough, he didn't have the same opinion of angels depicted in Renaissance art, human children with wings sprouting on their scapulae, which were probably just as monstrous to some Indian eyes. As a medical man, I might add that multiple arms in humans do occasionally crop up, a staple of freak shows in the old days, but a human being sprouting wings is impossible. However, a recent survey revealed that about one-third of all Americans claim they have seen angels, a frequency that's higher than even Elvis sightings. So works of art are not photocopies. They involve deliberate hyperbole and distortion of reality. But you can't just randomly distort an image and call it art, although here in La Jolla many do. The question is, what types of distortion are effective? Are there any rules that the artist deploys, either consciously or unconsciously, to change the image in a systematic way? And if so, how universal are these rules? While I was struggling with this question and poring over ancient Indian manuals on art and aesthetics, I often noticed the word rasa. This Sanskrit word is difficult to translate, but roughly it means capturing the very essence, the very spirit of something, in order to evoke a specific mood or emotion in the viewer's brain. I realize that if you want to understand art, you have to understand rasa and how it is represented in the neural circuitry in the brain. One afternoon, in a whimsical mood, I sat at the entrance of the temple and jotted down what I thought might be the 8 universal laws of aesthetics, analogous to the Buddha's eightfold path to wisdom and enlightenment. I later came up with an additional 9th law. So there, Buddha. These are rules of thumb that the artist or even fashion designer deploys to create visually pleasing images that more optimally titillate the visual areas in the brain compared with what he could accomplish using realistic images or real objects. In the pages that follow, I will elaborate on these laws. Some, I believe, are genuinely new, or at least haven't been stated explicitly in the context of visual art. Others are well known to artists, art historians, and philosophers. My goal is not to provide a complete account of the neurology of aesthetics, even assuming such a thing were possible, but to tie strands together from many different disciplines and to provide a coherent framework. Samir Zeki, a neuroscientist at the University College of London, has embarked on a similar venture, which he calls neuroaesthetics. Please be assured that this type of analysis doesn't in any way detract from the more lofty, spiritual dimensions of art, any more than describing the physiology of sexuality in the brain detracts from the magic of romantic love. We are dealing with different levels of descriptions that complement rather than contradict each other. No one would deny that sexuality is a strong component of romantic love. In addition to identifying and cataloging these laws, we also need to understand what their function might be, if any, and why they evolved. This is an important difference between the laws of biology and the laws of physics. The latter exist simply because they exist, even though the physicist may wonder why they always seem so simple and elegant to the human mind. Biological laws, on the other hand, must have evolved because they helped the organism deal with the world reliably, enabling it to survive and transmit its genes more efficiently. This isn't always true, but it's true often enough to make it worthwhile for a biologist to constantly keep it in mind. So the quest for biological laws shouldn't be driven by a quest for simplicity or elegance. No woman who has been through labor would say that it's an elegant solution to giving birth to a baby. Moreover, to assert there might be universal laws of aesthetics and art does not in any way diminish the important role of culture in the creation and appreciation of art. Without cultures, there wouldn't be distinct styles of art, such as Indian and Western. My interest is not in the differences between various artistic styles, but in principles that cut across cultural barriers, even if those principles account for only, say, 20% of the variance seen in art. Of course, cultural variations in art are fascinating, but I would argue that certain systematic principles lie behind these variations. Here are the names of my 9 laws of aesthetics. 1. Grouping. 2. Peak shift. 3. Contrast. 4. Isolation. 5. Peekaboo, or perceptual problem solving. 6. Abhorrence of coincidences. 7. Orderliness. 8. Symmetry. 9. Metaphor. It isn't enough to just list these laws and describe them. We need a coherent biological perspective. In particular, when exploring any universal human trait, such as humor, music, art, or language, we need to keep in mind 3 basic questions. Roughly speaking, what, why, and how. First, what is the internal logical structure of the particular trait you are looking at, corresponding roughly to what I call laws? For example, the law of grouping simply means that the visual system tends to group similar elements or features in the image into clusters. Second, why does the particular trait have the logical structure that it does? In other words, what is the biological function it evolved for? And third, how is the trait or law mediated by the neural machinery in the brain? All 3 of these questions need to be answered before we can genuinely claim to have understood any aspect of human nature. In my view, most older approaches to aesthetics have either failed or remained frustratingly incomplete with regard to these questions. For example, the Gestalt psychologists were good at pointing out laws of perception, but didn't correctly answer why such laws may have evolved or how they came to be enshrined in the neural architecture of the brain. Gestalt psychologists regarded the laws as byproducts of some undiscovered physical principles, such as electrical fields in the brain. Evolutionary psychologists are often good at pointing out what function a law might serve, but are typically not concerned with specifying in clear logical terms what the law actually is, with exploring its underlying neural mechanisms, or even with establishing whether the law exists or not. For instance, is there a law of cooking in the brain, because most cultures cook? And last, the worst offenders are neurophysiologists, except the very best ones, who seem interested in neither the functional logic nor the evolutionary rationale of the neural circuits they explore so diligently. This is amazing, given that, as Theodosius Dobzhansky famously said, nothing in biology makes any sense except in the light of evolution. A useful analogy comes from Horace Barlow, a British visual neuroscientist whose work is central to understanding the statistics of natural scenes. Imagine that a Martian biologist arrives on Earth. The Martian is asexual and reproduces by duplication, like an amoeba, so it doesn't know anything about sex. The Martian dissects a man's testicles, studies its microstructure in excruciating detail, and finds innumerable sperm swimming around. Unless the Martian knew about sex, which it doesn't, it wouldn't have the foggiest understanding of the structure and function of the testes despite all its meticulous dissections. The Martian would be mystified by these spherical balls dangling in half the human population and might even conclude that the wriggling sperm were parasites. The plight of many of my colleagues in physiology is not unlike that of the Martian. Knowing the minute detail doesn't necessarily mean you comprehend the function of the whole from its parts. So, with the three overarching principles of internal logic, evolutionary function, and neural mechanics in mind, let's see the role each of my individual laws plays in constructing a neurobiological view of aesthetics. Let's begin with a concrete example: grouping. The law of grouping. The law of grouping was discovered by Gestalt psychologists around the turn of the century. Take a moment to look again at Figure 2-7, the Dalmatian dog in Chapter 2. All you see at first is a set of random splotches, but after several seconds, you start grouping some of the splotches together. You see a Dalmatian dog sniffing the ground. Your brain glues the dog splotches together to form a single object that is clearly delineated from the shadows of leaves around it. This is well known, but vision scientists frequently overlook the fact that successful grouping feels good. You get an internal aha sensation, as if you have just solved a problem. Grouping is used by both artists and fashion designers. In some well-known classic Renaissance paintings, the same azure blue color repeats all over the canvas as part of various unrelated objects. Likewise, the same beige and brown are used in halos, clothes, and hair throughout the scene. The artist uses a limited set of colors rather than an enormous range of colors. Again, your brain enjoys grouping similar colored splotches. It feels good, just as it felt good to group the dog splotches, and the artist exploits this. He doesn't do this because he is stingy with paint or has only a limited palette. Think of the last time you selected a mat to frame a painting. If there are bits of blue in the painting, you pick a mat that's tinted blue. If there are mainly green earth tones in the painting, then a brown mat looks most pleasing to the eye. The same holds for fashion. When you go to Nordstrom's department store to buy a red skirt, the salesperson will advise you to buy a red scarf and a red belt to go with it. Or if you are a guy buying a blue suit, the salesperson may recommend a tie with some identical blue flecks to go with the suit. But what's all this really about? Is there a logical reason for grouping colors? Is it just marketing and hype? Or is this telling you something fundamental about the brain? This is the why question. The answer is that grouping evolved, to a surprisingly large extent, to defeat camouflage and to detect objects in cluttered scenes. This seems counterintuitive because when you look around, objects are clearly visible, certainly not camouflaged. In a modern urban environment, objects are so commonplace that we don't realize vision is mainly about detecting objects so that you can avoid them, dodge them, chase them, eat them, or mate with them. We take the familiar for granted, but just think of one of your arboreal ancestors trying to spot a lion hidden behind a screen of green splotches, a tree branch, say. Only visible are several yellow splotches of lion fragments, figure 7-4. But your brain says, in effect, what's the likelihood that all these fragments are exactly the same color by coincidence? Zero. So they probably belong to one object. So let me glue them together to see what it is. Aha! Oops! It's a lion! Run! This seemingly esoteric ability to group splotches may have made all the difference between life and death. Little does the salesperson at Nordstrom realize that when she picks the matching red scarf for your red skirt, she is tapping into a deep principle underlying brain organization, and that she's taking advantage of the fact that your brain evolved to detect predators seen behind foliage. Again, grouping feels good. Of course, the red scarf and red skirt are not one object, so logically they shouldn't be grouped. But that doesn't stop her from exploiting the grouping law anyway to create an attractive combination. The point is, the rule worked in the treetops in which our brains evolved. It was valid often enough that incorporating it as a law into our visual brain centers helped our ancestors leave behind more babies, and that's all that matters in evolution. The fact that an artist can misapply the rule in an individual painting, making you group splotches from different objects, is irrelevant because your brain is fooled and enjoys the grouping anyway. Another principle of perceptual grouping, known as good continuation, states that graphic elements suggesting a continued visual contour will tend to be grouped together. I recently tried constructing a version of it that might be especially relevant to aesthetics, Figure 7.5. Figure 7.5b is unattractive, even though it is made of components whose shapes and arrangement are similar to Figure 7.5a, which is pleasing to the eye. This is because of the aha jolt you get from completion, grouping, of object boundaries behind occluders, 7.5a, whereas in 7.5b there is irresolvable tension. And now we need to answer the how question, the neural mediation of the law. When you see a large lion through foliage, the different yellow lion fragments occupy separate regions of the visual field, yet your brain glues them together. How? Each fragment excites a separate cell, or small cluster of cells, in widely separated portions of the visual cortex and color areas of the brain. Each cell signals the presence of the feature by means of a volley of nerve impulses, a train of what are called spikes. The exact sequence of spikes is random. If you show the same feature to the same cell, it will fire again just as vigorously, but there's a new random sequence of impulses that isn't identical to the first. What seems to matter for recognition is not the exact pattern of nerve impulses, but which neurons fire and how much they fire, a principle known as Mueller's Law of Specific Nerve Energies. Proposed in 1826, the law states that the different perceptual qualities evoked in the brain by sound, light, and pinprick, namely hearing, seeing, and pain, are not caused by differences in patterns of activation, but by different locations of nervous structures excited by those stimuli. That's the standard story, but an astonishing new discovery by two neuroscientists, Wolf Singer of the Max Planck Institute for Brain Research in Frankfurt, Germany, and Charles Gray from Montana State University, adds a novel twist to it. They found that if a monkey looks at a big object of which only fragments are visible, then many cells fire in parallel to signal the different fragments. That's what you would expect. But surprisingly, as soon as the features are grouped into a whole object, in this case a lion, all the spike trains become perfectly synchronized. And so the exact spike trains do matter. We don't yet know how this occurs, but Singer and Gray suggest that this synchrony tells higher brain centers that the fragments belong to a single object. I would take this argument a step further and suggest that this synchrony allows the spike trains to be encoded in such a way that a coherent output emerges, which is relayed to the emotional core of the brain, creating an, aha, look here, it's an object, jolt in you. This jolt arouses you and makes you swivel your eyeballs and head toward the object so you can pay attention to it, identify it, and take action. It's this aha signal that the artist or designer exploits when she uses grouping. This isn't as far-fetched as it sounds. There are known back projections from the amygdala and other limbic structures, such as the nucleus accumbens, to almost every visual area in the hierarchy of visual processing discussed in Chapter 2. Surely these projections play a role in mediating the visual aha. The remaining universal laws of aesthetics are less well understood, but that hasn't stopped me from speculating on their evolution. This isn't easy. Some laws may not themselves have a function, but may be byproducts of other laws that do. In fact, some of the laws actually seem to contradict each other, which may actually turn out to be a blessing. science often progresses by resolving apparent contradictions. The law of peak shift. My second universal law, the peak shift effect, relates to how your brain responds to exaggerated stimuli. I should point out that the phrase peak shift has a purportedly precise meaning in the animal learning literature, whereas I am using it more loosely. It explains why caricatures are so appealing. As I mentioned earlier, ancient Sanskrit manuals on aesthetics often use the word rasa, which translates roughly to capturing the very essence of something. But how exactly does the artist extract the very essence of something and portray it in a painting or a sculpture? And how does your brain respond to rasa? A clue, oddly enough, comes from studies in animal behavior, especially the behavior of rats and pigeons that are taught to respond to certain visual images. Imagine a hypothetical experiment in which a rat is being taught to discriminate a rectangle from a square, figure 7-6. Every time the animal approaches the rectangle, you give it a piece of cheese, but if it goes to the square, you don't. After a few dozen trials, the rat learns that rectangle equals food. It begins to ignore the square and go toward the rectangle alone. In other words, it now likes the rectangle. But amazingly, if you now show the rat a longer and skinnier rectangle than the one you showed it originally, it actually prefers that rectangle to the original. You may be tempted to say, well, that's a bit silly. Why would the rat actually choose the new rectangle rather than the one you trained it with? The answer is, the rat isn't being silly at all. It has learned a rule, rectangularity, rather than a particular prototype rectangle, so from its point of view, the more rectangular, the better. By that, one means the higher the ratio of a longer side to a shorter side, the better. The more you emphasize the contrast between the rectangle and the square, the more attractive it is. So when shown the long, skinny one, the rat thinks, wow, what a rectangle. This effect is called peak shift because ordinarily when you teach an animal something, its peak response is to the stimulus you trained it with. But if you train the animal to discriminate something, in this case a rectangle, from something else, the square, the peak response is to a totally new rectangle that is shifted away even further from the square in its rectangularity. What has peak shift got to do with art? Think of caricatures. As I mentioned in Chapter 2, if you want to draw a caricature of Nixon's face, you take all those features of Nixon that make his face special and different from the average face, such as his big nose and shaggy eyebrows, and you amplify them. Or to put it differently, you take the mathematical average of all male faces and subtract this average from Nixon's face, and then amplify the difference. By doing this, you have created a picture that's even more Nixon-like than the original Nixon. In short, you have captured the very essence, the rasa, of Nixon. If you overdo it, you get a humorous effect, a caricature, because it doesn't look even human. But if you do it right, you get great portraiture. Caricatures and portraits aside, how does this principle apply to other art forms? Take a second look at the goddess Parvati, which conveys the essence of feminine sensuality, poise, charm, and dignity. How does the artist achieve this? A first-pass answer is that he has subtracted the average male form from the average female form and amplified the difference. The net result is a woman with exaggerated breasts and hips and an attenuated hourglass waist, slender yet voluptuous. The fact that she doesn't look like your average real woman is irrelevant. You like the sculpture just as the rat liked the skinnier rectangle more than the original prototype, saying, in effect, wow, what a woman. But there's surely more to it than that. Otherwise, any Playboy pinup would be a work of art. Although, to be sure, I've never seen a pinup whose waist is as narrow as the goddess's. Parvati is not merely a sexy babe. She is the very embodiment of feminine perfection, of grace and poise. How does the artist achieve this? He does so by accentuating not merely her breasts and hips, but also her feminine posture, formerly known as tribhanga, or triple flexion in Sanskrit. There are certain postures that a woman can adopt effortlessly, but are impossible or highly improbable in a man because of anatomical differences such as the width of the pelvis, the angle between the neck and shaft of the femur, the curvature of the lumbar spine. Instead of subtracting male form from female form, the artist goes into a more abstract posture space, subtracting the average male posture from the average female posture, and then amplifies the difference. The result is an exquisitely feminine posture, conveying poise and grace. Now take a look at the dancing nymph in figure 7-7, whose twisting torso is almost anatomically absurd, but who nevertheless conveys an incredibly beautiful sense of movement and dance. This is probably achieved, once again, by the deliberate exaggeration of posture that may activate, indeed, hyperactivate, mirror neurons in the superior temporal sulcus. These cells respond powerfully when a person is viewing changing postures and movements of the body, as well as changing facial expressions. Remember Pathway 3, the so what stream in vision processing discussed in Chapter 2? Perhaps sculptures such as the dancing nymph are producing an especially powerful stimulation of certain classes of mirror neurons, resulting in a correspondingly heightened reading of the body language of dynamic postures. It's hardly surprising, then, that even most types of dance, Indian or Western, involve clever, ritualized exaggerations of movements and postures that convey specific emotions. Remember Michael Jackson? The relevance of the peak shift law to caricatures and to the human body is obvious, but how about other kinds of art? Can we even begin to approach Van Gogh, Rodin, Gustav Klimt, Henry Moore, or Picasso? What can neuroscience tell us about abstract and semi-abstract art? This is where most theories of art either fail or start invoking culture, but I'd like to suggest that we don't really need to. The important clue to understanding these so-called higher art forms comes from a very unexpected source, ethology, the science of animal behavior, in particular from the work of the Nobel Prize-winning biologist Nicholas Tinbergen, who did his pioneering work on seagulls in the 1950s. Tinbergen studied herring gulls, common on both the English and American coasts. The mother gull has a prominent red spot on her long yellow beak. The gull chick, soon after it hatches from the egg, begs for food by pecking vigorously on the red spot on the mother's beak. The mother then regurgitates half-digested food into her chick's gaping mouth. Tinbergen asked himself a very simple question. How does the chick recognize its mom? Why doesn't it beg for food from any animal that's passing by? Tinbergen found that to elicit this begging behavior in the chick, you don't really need a mother seagull. When he waved a disembodied beak in front of the chick, it pecked at the red spot just as vigorously, begging the beak-wielding human for food. The chick's behavior, confusing a human adult for a mother seagull, might seem silly, but it isn't. Remember, vision evolved to discover and respond to objects, recognize them, dodge them, eat them, catch them, or mate with them, quickly and reliably by doing as little work as needed for the job at hand, taking shortcuts where necessary to minimize computational load. Through millions of years of accumulated evolutionary wisdom, the gull chick's brain has learned that the only time it will see a long yellow thing with a red spot on the end is when there's a mom attached to it at the other end. After all, in nature, the chick is never likely to encounter a mutant pig with a beak or a malicious ethologist waving around a fake beak. So the chick's brain can take advantage of this statistical redundancy in nature, and the equation long thing with red spot equals mom gets hardwired into its brain. In fact, Tinbergen found that you don't even need a beak. You can just have a rectangular strip of cardboard with a red dot on the end, and the chick will beg for food equally vigorously. This happens because the chick brain's visual machinery isn't perfect. It's wired up in such a way that it has a high enough hit rate in detecting mom to survive and leave offspring. So you can readily fool these neurons by providing a visual stimulus that approximates the original, just as a key doesn't have to be absolutely perfect to fit a cheap lock. It can be rusty or slightly corroded. But the best is yet to come. To his amazement, Tinbergen found that if he had a very long, thick stick with three red stripes on the end, the chick goes berserk, pecking at it much more intensely than at a real beak. It actually prefers this strange pattern, which bears almost no resemblance to the original. Tinbergen doesn't tell us why this happens, but it's almost as though the chick had stumbled on a superbeak, figure 7-8. Why could such a thing happen? We really don't know the alphabet of visual perception, whether in gulls or humans. Obviously, neurons in the visual centers of the gull's brain, which have fancy Latin names like nucleus rotundum, hyperstriatum, and ectostriatum, are not optimally functioning machines. They are merely wired up in such a way that they can detect beaks, and therefore mothers, reliably enough. Survival is the only thing evolution cares about. The neuron may have a rule like, the more red outline, the better. So if you show it a long, skinny stick with three stripes, the cell actually likes it even more. This is related to the peak shift effect on rats mentioned earlier, except for one key difference. In the case of the rat responding to the skinnier rectangle, it's perfectly obvious what rule the animal has learned and what you are amplifying. But in the case of the seagull, the stick with three stripes is hardly an exaggerated version of a real beak. It isn't clear at all what rule you are tapping into or amplifying. The heightened response to the striped beak may be an inadvertent consequence of the way the cells are wired up, rather than the deployment of a rule with an obvious function. We need a new name for this type of stimulus, so I'll call it an ultra-normal stimulus, to distinguish it from supernormal, a phrase that already exists. The response to an ultra-normal stimulus pattern, such as the three-striped beak, cannot be predicted from looking at the original, the single-spot beak. You could predict the response, at least in theory, if you knew in detail the functional logic of the circuitry in the chick's brain that allows the rapid, efficient detection of beaks. You could then devise patterns that actually excite these neurons even more effectively than the original stimulus, so the chick's brain goes, "Wow, what a sexy beak!" Or you might be able to discover the ultra-normal stimulus by trial and error, stumbling on it, as Tinbergen did. This brings me to my punchline about semi-abstract or even abstract art, for which no adequate theory has been proposed so far. Imagine that seagulls had an art gallery. They would hang this long, thin stick with three stripes on the wall. They would call it a Picasso, worship it, fetishize it, and pay millions of dollars for it, while all the time wondering why they are turned on by it so much, even though, and this is the key point, it doesn't resemble anything in their world. I suggest this is exactly what human art connoisseurs are doing when they look at or purchase abstract works of art. They are behaving exactly like gull chicks. By trial and error, intuition, or genius, human artists like Picasso or Henry Moore have discovered the human brain's equivalent of the seagull brain's stick with three stripes. They are tapping into the figural primitives of our perceptual grammar and creating ultra-normal stimuli that more powerfully excite certain visual neurons in our brains as opposed to realistic-looking images. This is the essence of abstract art. It may sound like a highly reductionist, oversimplified view of art, but bear in mind that I'm not saying that's all there is to art, only that it's an important component. The same principle may apply to Impressionist art, a Van Gogh or a Monet canvas. In Chapter 2, I noted that visual space is organized in the brain so that spatially adjacent points are mapped one-to-one onto adjacent points on the cortex. Moreover, out of the 30 or so areas in the human brain, A few, especially V4, are devoted primarily to color. But in the color area, wavelengths adjacent in an abstract color space are mapped onto adjacent points in the brain even when they are not near each other in external space. Perhaps Monet and Van Gogh were introducing peak shifts in abstract color space rather than form space, even deliberately smudging form when required. A black-and-white Monet is an oxymoron. This principle of ultranormal stimuli may be relevant not just to art, but to other quirks of aesthetic preference as well, like whom you are attracted to. Each of us carries templates for members of the opposite sex, such as your mother or father, or your first really sizzling amorous encounter, and maybe those whom you find inexplicably and disproportionately attractive later in life are ultra-normal versions of these early prototypes. So the next time you are unaccountably, even perversely attracted to someone who is not beautiful in any obvious sense, don't jump to the conclusion that it's just pheromones or the right chemistry. Consider the possibility that she or he is an ultra-normal version of the gender you're attracted to, buried deep in your unconscious. It's a strange thought that human life is built on such quicksand, governed largely by vagaries and accidental encounters from the past, even though we take such great pride in our aesthetic sensibilities and freedom of choice. On this one point, I am in complete agreement with Freud. There is a potential objection to the notion that our brains are at least partially hardwired to appreciate art. If this were really true, then why doesn't everyone like Henry Moore or Achola Bronze? This is an important question. The surprising answer might be that everyone does like a Henry Moore or Parvati, but not everyone knows it. The key to understanding this quandary is to recognize that the human brain has many quasi-independent modules that can at times signal inconsistent information. It may be that all of us have basic neural circuits in our visual areas which show a heightened response to a Henry Moore sculpture, given that it is constructed out of certain form primitives that hyperactivate cells that are tuned to respond to these primitives. But perhaps in many of us, other higher cognitive systems, such as the mechanisms of language and thought in the left hemisphere, kick in and censor or veto the output of the face neurons by saying, in effect, "There is something wrong with this sculpture. It looks like a funny, twisted blob, so ignore that strong signal from cells at an earlier stage in your visual processing." In short, I am saying all of us do like Henry Moore, but many of us are in denial about it. The idea that people who claim not to like Henry Moore are closet Henry Moore enthusiasts could, in principle, be tested with brain imaging. And the same holds for the Victorian Englishman's response to the Chola Bronze Parvati. An even more striking example of quirky aesthetic preference is the manner in which certain guppies prefer decoys of the opposite sex that are painted blue, even though there's nothing in the guppy that's blue. If a chance mutation were to occur, making one guppy blue, I predict the emergence of a future race of guppies in the next few millennia that evolve to become uselessly, intensely blue. Could the appeal of silver foil to bowerbirds and the universal appeal of shiny metallic jewelry and precious stones to people also be based on some idiosyncratic quirk of brain wiring? Maybe evolved for detecting water? It's a sobering thought when you consider how many wars have been fought, loves lost, and lives ruined for the sake of precious stones.
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.
So far, I have discussed only two of my 9 laws. The remaining 7 are the subject of the next chapter. But before we continue, I want to take up one final challenge. The ideas I have considered so far on abstract and semi-abstract art and portraiture sound plausible, but how do we know they actually are true? The only way to find out would be to do experiments. This may seem obvious. A familiar face like your mother or Angelina Jolie deep structure underlying all languages. Nor should the diamond you are about to give your lover lose its radiance or romance if you tell her that it was made of carbon and was forged in the bowels of Earth when the solar system was born. In fact, the diamond's appeal should be enhanced. Similarly, our conviction that great art can be divinely inspired and may have spiritual significance, or that it transcends not only realism but reality itself, should not stop us from looking for those elemental forces in the brain that govern our aesthetic impulses. Chapter 8. The Artful Brain, Universal Laws. Art is the accomplishment of our desire to find ourselves among the phenomena of the external world. Richard Wagner. Before moving on to the next 7 laws, I want to clarify what I mean by universal. To say that the wiring in your visual centers embodies universal laws does not negate the critical role of culture and experience in shaping your brain and mind. Many cognitive faculties that are fundamental to your human way of life are only partly specified by your genes. Nature and nurture interact. Genes wire up your brain's emotional and cortical circuits to a certain extent, and then leave it to faith that the environment will shape your brain the rest of the way, producing you, the individual. In this respect, the human brain is absolutely unique, as symbiotic with culture as a hermit crab is with its shell. While the laws are hardwired, the content is learned. Consider face recognition. While your ability to learn faces is innate, you are not born knowing your mother's face or the mail carrier's face. Your specialized face cells learn to recognize faces through exposure to the people you encounter. Once face knowledge is acquired, the circuitry may spontaneously respond more effectively to caricatures or cubist portraits. Once your brain learns about other classes of objects or shapes, bodies, animals, automobiles, and such, your innate circuitry may spontaneously display the peak shift principle or respond to bizarre ultranormal stimuli analogous to the stick with stripes. Because this ability emerges in all human emotional arousal when you look at anything. If you look at something scary, violent, or sexy, or as it turns out, a familiar face like your mother or Angelina Jolie, there is a big jolt in GSR. But nothing happens if you look at a shoe or furniture. This is a better test of someone's raw, gut-level emotional reactions to the world than asking what she feels. A person's verbal response is likely to be inauthentic. It may be contaminated by the opinions of other areas of the brain. So GSR gives us a handy experimental probe for understanding art. If my conjectures about the appeal of Henry Moore sculptures are correct, then the Renaissance scholar who denies an interest in such abstract works, or for that matter, the English art historian who feigns indifference to Chola bronzes, should nevertheless register a whopping GSR to the very images whose aesthetic appeal he denies. His skin can't lie. Similarly, we know that you will show a higher GSR to a photo of your mother than to a photo of a stranger, and I predict that the difference will be even greater if you look at a caricature or evocative sketch of your mother rather than at a realistic photo. This would be interesting because it's counterintuitive. As a control for comparison, you could use a counter-caricature, by which I mean a sketch that deviates from the prototype toward the average face rather than away from it, or indeed a face outline that deviates in a random direction. This would ensure that any enhanced GSR you observed with the caricature wasn't simply because of the surprise caused by the distortion. It would be genuinely due to its appeal as a caricature. But GSR can only take us so far. It is a relatively coarse measure because it pools several types of arousal, and it can't discriminate positive from negative responses. But even though it's a crude measure, it's not a bad place to start, because it can tell the experimenter when you are indifferent to a work of art and when you are feigning indifference. The criticism that the test can't discriminate negative arousal from positive arousal, at least not yet, isn't as damaging as it sounds, because who is to say that negative arousal isn't also part of art? Indeed, attention-grabbing, whether initially positive or negative, is often a prelude to attraction. After all, slaughtered cows pickled in formaldehyde were displayed in the venerable MoMA, Museum of Modern Art, in New York, sending shockwaves throughout the art world. There are many layers of reaction to art which contribute to its richness and appeal. A second approach is to use eye movements, in particular, a technique pioneered by the Russian psychologist Alfred Jarbus. You can use an electronic optical device to see where a person is fixating and how she is moving her eyes from one region to another in a painting. The fixations tend to be clustered around eyes and lips. One could therefore show a normally proportioned cartoon of a person on one side of the image and a hyperbolic version on the other side. I would predict that even though the normal cartoon looks more natural, the eye fixations will cluster more around the caricature. A randomly distorted cartoon could be included to control for novelty. These findings could be used to complement the GSR results. The third experimental approach to aesthetics would be to record from cells along the visual pathways in primates and compare their responses to art versus any old picture. The advantage of recording from single cells is that it may eventually allow a more fine-grained analysis of the neurology of aesthetics than what could be achieved with GSR alone. We know that there are cells in a region called the fusiform gyrus that respond mainly to specific familiar faces. You have brain cells that fire in response to a picture of your mother, your boss, Bill Clinton, or Madonna. I predict that a boss cell in this face recognition region should show an even bigger response to a caricature of your boss than to an authentic, undistorted face of your boss, and perhaps an even smaller response to a plain-looking counter-caricature. I first suggested this in a paper I wrote with Bill Hurstein in the mid-1990s. The experiment has now been done on monkeys by researchers at Harvard and MIT, and sure enough, the caricatures hyperactivate the face cells as expected. Their results provide grounds for optimism that some of the other laws of aesthetics I have proposed may also turn out to be true. There is a widespread fear among scholars in the humanities and arts that science may someday take over their discipline and deprive them of employment, a syndrome I have dubbed neuron envy. Nothing could be further from the truth. Our appreciation of Shakespeare is not diminished by the existence of a universal grammar or Chomskyan deep structure underlying all languages. Nor should the diamond you are about to give your lover lose its radiance or romance if you tell her that it was made of carbon and was forged in the bowels of Earth when the solar system was born. In fact, the diamond's appeal should be enhanced. Similarly, our conviction that great art can be divinely inspired and may have spiritual significance, or that it transcends not only realism but reality itself, should not stop us from looking for those elemental forces in the brain that govern our aesthetic impulses. Chapter 8. The Artful Brain, Universal Laws. Art is the accomplishment of our desire to find ourselves among the phenomena of the external world. Richard Wagner. Before moving on to the next seven laws, I want to clarify what I mean by universal. To say that the wiring in your visual centers embodies universal laws does not negate the critical role of culture and experience in shaping your brain and mind. Many cognitive faculties that are fundamental to your human way of life are only partly specified by your genes. Nature and nurture interact. Genes wire up your brain's emotional and cortical circuits to a certain extent, and then leave it to faith that the environment will shape your brain the rest of the way, producing you, the individual. In this respect, the human brain is absolutely unique, as symbiotic with culture as a hermit crab is with its shell. While the laws are hardwired, the content is learned. Consider face recognition. While your ability to learn faces is innate, you are not born knowing your mother's face or the mail carrier's face. Your specialized face cells learn to recognize faces through exposure to the people you encounter. Once face knowledge is acquired, the circuitry may spontaneously respond more effectively to caricatures or cubist portraits. Once your brain learns about other classes of objects or shapes, bodies, animals, automobiles, and such, your innate circuitry may spontaneously display the peak shift principle or respond to bizarre ultranormal stimuli analogous to the stick with stripes. Because this ability emerges in all human brains that develop normally, we are safe in calling it universal. Contrast. It is hard to imagine a painting or sketch without contrast. Even the simplest doodle requires contrasting brightness between the black line and white background. White paint on a white canvas could hardly be called art, although in the 1990s, the purchase of an all-white painting figured in Yasmina Reyes's hilarious award-winning play, Art, poking fun at how easily people are influenced by art critics. In scientific parlance, contrast is a relatively sudden change in luminance, color, or some other property between two spatially contiguous homogeneous regions. We can speak of luminance contrast, color contrast, texture contrast, or even depth contrast. The bigger the difference between the two regions, the higher the contrast. Contrast is important in art or design. In a sense, it's a minimum requirement. It creates edges and boundaries, as well as figures against background. With zero contrast, you see nothing at all. Too little contrast, and a design can be bland. And too much contrast can be confusing. Some contrast combinations are more pleasing to the eye than others. For example, high contrast colors such as blue splotch on a yellow background are more attention-grabbing than low contrast pairings like a yellow splotch on an orange background. It's puzzling at first glance. After all, you can easily see a yellow object against an orange background, but that combination does not draw your attention the same way as blue on yellow. The reason a boundary of high color contrast is more attention-getting can be traced to our primate origins, to when we swung arm over arm like Spider-Man in the unruly treetops, in dim twilight, or across great distances. Many fruits are red on green, so our primate eyes will see them. The plants advertise themselves so animals and birds can spot them from a great distance, knowing they are ripe and ready to eat, and can be dispersed through defecation of the seeds. If trees on Mars were mainly yellow, we would expect to see blue fruits. The law of contrast, juxtaposing dissimilar colors and/or luminances, might seem to contradict the law of grouping, which involves connecting similar or identical colors. And yet the evolutionary function of both principles is, broadly speaking, the same: to delineate and direct attention to object boundaries. In nature, both laws help species survive. Their main difference lies in the area over which the comparison or integration of colors occurs. Contrast detection involves comparing regions of color that lie right next to each other in visual space. This makes evolutionary sense because object boundaries usually coincide with contrasting luminance or color. Grouping, on the other hand, performs comparisons over wider distances. Its goal is to detect an object that is partially obscured, like a lion hiding behind a bush. Glue those yellow patches together perceptually, and it turns out to be one big lump shaped like a lion. In modern times, we harness contrast and grouping to serve novel purposes unrelated to their original survival function. For example, a good fashion designer will emphasize the salience of an edge by using dissimilar, highly contrasting colors, contrast, but will use similar colors for far-flung regions, grouping. As I mentioned in Chapter 7, red shoes go with a red shirt, conducive to grouping. It's true, of course, that the red shoes aren't an innate part of the red shirt, but the designer is tapping into the principle that, in our